This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan, broadcasting today from the Battelle Studio at WOSU at COSI, a science and technology museum in Columbus, Ohio. John McCain and Barack Obama took questions from voters at Belmont University in Nashville last night, the second of three presidential debates. Questions about Iraq, the economy, Pakistan and Afghanistan, the economy, healthcare, education, their voting records, and yes, the economy. It's Wednesday, and time for our weekly dose of the political junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
My mother was born before women could vote. My daughter got to vote for her mother for president.
But I'm the decider.
On Wednesdays, NPR's political editor Ken Rudin joins us to talk about the presidential campaign in particular and politics in general. This week, we're in the key swing state of Ohio with two presidential debates down, one to go. We'll listen to what the candidates had to say, and we'll hear from you. But the first business of order of business, as always, is trivia. Ken joins us.
Hi, Neil. It's very exciting to be here in Cleveland. I was kidding. John McCain, as you know, was born in the Panama Canal Zone, which is, of course, not a state. Who was the last presidential nominee from a major party who was not born in a state?
The last presidential nominee of a major party not born in a state. If you think you know the answer, give us a call, 800-989-8255. You can email us, talk@npr.org, and we'll also accept guesses from members of the audience here at COSI. And by the way, thank you, everybody, for coming in. We appreciate it. And, Ken, a lot of last night's debate in Nashville centered about the economy. It's in the headlines, obviously, again today. Wall Street dropped another 500 points yesterday. Anything new from the candidates that might change the dynamic of this race?
Well, the other thing new I heard in the debate was, of course, John McCain's proposal to have $300 billion going to pay for mortgages, people whose homes are about to be foreclosed. I think that was the only headlines that came out of it. But with the economy the way it is, with the 401ks in peril, with people's financial future in peril, I think that has taken over the dynamic of the race, has taken over the conversation of the race, and everything that John McCain did last night, everything from trying to disparage Barack Obama's experience and temperament to his signaling his own experience, seemed to fail. I mean, in the history of presidential debates, no presidential candidate has gone into a debate down 5, 6, 7 points and had a debate performance turn his fortunes around.
And that's what the spread is right now, 5, 6, 7, 8 points, depending on who you talk to?
With most national polls, but more importantly, if you look at the battleground states, if you look at all the states that John Kerry won in 2004, Barack Obama has a lead in every single one. Pennsylvania, even New Hampshire now, which had been seen as undecided, Minnesota, Michigan, states like that. It's the Republican states, the ones that President Bush won in 2004, like Virginia, like Ohio, like Florida. Those are states, and even North Carolina, which was not supposed to be close, but now is. Those are the states that are up for grabs. And again, that's bad news for John McCain because these are all so-called Republican states.
And let's see if we can get somebody who's ready to answer our trivia question. Again, if you think you know the last presidential nominee of a major party to be born not in one of our states, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And Eric is on the line with us. Eric from Columbia, South Carolina.
Yes, my answer was it Eisenhower?
Eisenhower, born in Kansas.
He was born in Kansas, and no, Kansas has been a state, still a state. Hurricane Ike, we used to call him back then. Yes, but no.
That was when he played football at Army.
That's exactly right.
Eric, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can try now Donald. Donald with us from Bernie in Texas.
Yes, sir, and I haven't Googled this. I'm taking a shot from high school, Herbert Hoover.
Damn, that's wrong.
Herbert Hoover, I think, was born in Iowa. He was born in Iowa, the last president besides Eisenhower not to have had served in elective office before he was elected president. But no, he was born in a state.
Thanks for the call, Donald. Let's see. Marlene has a guess. Marlene calling us from Overland Park in Kansas.
Was it George Romney?
Well, George Romney was born in Chihuahua, Mexico.
Which is a Mexican state.
True, but he was never the nominee of his party. He sought the nomination in 1968, but he did not win it. Richard Nixon got the nomination that year, so
nice
not
try,
Romney.
Let's see if we can go now to Matt. And Matt's with us from Mishawaka in Indiana.
Hello, was it Barry Goldwater?
That is correct.
Barry Goldwater. Thank you very much, Matt.
Barry Goldwater was born January 1st, 1909, in a territory called Arizona, not yet a state. Arizona didn't become a state until 1912. And I knew that because I have a sense of humor. Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks. Matt, you win this week's No Prize. Thanks very much for giving us a call.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye, Matt. Let's go back to the debate last night and the presidential politics. We have somebody here in the audience at COSI who's got a question. Go ahead, please. Nina.
Last night's debate featured an audience of undecided voters, and I'd like to know more about undecided voters. What do we know historically and demographically about those who are undecided 1 month out from an election, and is it different this year?
Well, I think that's a very good question. Not that I think it's a very good question. It is a very good question. But I think the answer is interesting because a lot of it, I suspect, has to do with the uniqueness of the candidates this year, especially Barack Obama. There are some people who agree, have talked about to pollsters that they agree with Obama's positions on the economy, on the war, on the U.S. role in foreign affairs, and yet there's something about Barack Obama that they don't feel quite comfortable with. Is the word race? It could be race. It could be lack of experience. It could be an assortment of issues. So I suspect that that's what's driving a lot of these undecided voters. Yesterday, when Neil and I were here in Columbus talking about prior to the debate, we had a lot of people who seemed undecided, and a lot of them, I think, they would like to have voted for McCain or Obama, but they just weren't sure because I think the economy has changed all their views. So historically, I think if you're undecided, I think you drift. In other words, in this year, it seemed like the people who want Barack Obama, or at least the people who want change from the last 8 years, have decided that very early. I suspect that many of these people who were undecided were probably either Republicans or wavering Republicans or people who would have liked to have voted for McCain but did not because of the course of what's gone on in the last 8 years, but especially the last couple of weeks with the economy.
Nina, what about you? Are you undecided?
No. I'm one of those people who decided very early.
And did you vote early, just out of curiosity?
I have not
there,
yet.
There was a period, a window, which people in Ohio could vote early.
I like to vote on Election Day.
Ah, one of the traditionalists here in the Midwest. Thanks very much for coming to the microphone for us. And let me get back to the debate last night. Obviously, the economy was one of the huge issues. And one of the questioners, this was a town hall type meeting, asked, you know, this $700 billion bailout bill or rescue bill, whatever you're going to call it, what is in it for me? What's it going to help? What's it going to do for me to help me out? And this is what Senator McCain had to say.
One of the real catalysts, really the match that lit this fire, was Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. I'll bet you may never even have heard of them before this crisis. But, you know, they're the ones that with the encouragement of Senator Obama and his cronies and his friends in Washington that went out and made all these risky loans, gave them to people that couldn't never afford to pay back.
That answer turned quickly into an assault on the other candidate standing next to him there on the stage at Belmont University. And, of course, when Barack Obama's turn came, he turned the fire back on John McCain.
Now, with respect to Fannie Mae, what Senator McCain didn't mention is the fact that this bill that he talked about wasn't his own bill. He jumped on it a year after it had been introduced, and it never got passed. And I never promoted Fannie Mae. In fact, Senator McCain's campaign chairman's firm was a lobbyist on behalf of Fannie Mae, not me.
And this is this was something that happened all night long. The candidates would open fire on each other and then say, but really, the voters want to hear about the issues, not personal attacks on my
Well, about
opponent.
This specifically, actually, Barack Obama made a mistake. John McCain's campaign manager, Rick Davis, was a lobbyist not for Fannie Mae, but for Freddie Mac. I was surprised that Obama made that mistake. But also, I was surprised that John McCain went after Obama on this issue of Freddie and Fannie. Of course, Obama does have ties to Fannie Mae. Jim Johnson had been the original chairman, former CEO of Fannie Mae, had been his original chairman of his vice presidential search committee, of course was forced out after some financial things. But so Barack Obama clearly has ties to Fannie Mae, but John McCain hasn't to Freddie Mac. But more importantly, we saw Tom Brokaw yesterday, we saw Jim Lehrer 2 weeks ago, and we saw members of the audience last night as well, trying to get specifics. If this is the worst financial problem, crisis, since the Great Depression, 1929, what specifics are you talking about? What sacrifices are we willing to make, or are you willing to make in your campaign? And neither candidate, I thought, was able to do that.
We also thought ahead of the debate yesterday that the gloves were going to come off. There were questions being raised by John McCain's running mate, Sarah Palin, about Barack Obama's minister, new questions about William Ayers, the former terrorist, a member of the Weather Underground, who was associated with Barack Obama back in his old Chicago days. And, well, those issues didn't come up, nor did the Obama's allegations about the Keating Five.
No, I don't know about new questions or new allegations, certainly old ones, but they were certainly recycled. Look, when you're down as much, if you're 5-6 points, doesn't sound like a lot, but if it's 5-6 points in every state, then it's really could be an electoral college landslide. John McCain needed to change the subject, needed to change the dynamic, but I think when you're in a town hall meeting, it's one thing to be on stage with one moderator and that's it, and you could just, you know, launch an assault and things like that. But when you have these 90 people sitting there, you know, people who may be offended by such personal attacks, it seemed more and more difficult. The only thing I heard that made me wince was a conversation about an energy bill. John McCain is talking about this energy bill. He said that Bush and Cheney voted for it. But, you know, guess who? But I opposed it. You know who supported it? That one. I thought that was a dismissive remark that made me almost uncomfortable. I don't know if it was... No,
No. I wasn't waving at you. Okay. I was waving at my director, Gwen Newton.
But I was wondering. It just seemed a little contemptuous remark by McCain. You know that he doesn't want to be there. You know that John McCain talks about his own experience, his long experience in the country, and Barack Obama's only been in the Senate for 15 minutes, according to them. But I thought that was a kind of remark that seemed dismissive and as negative as it got.
We're in the swing state of Ohio with political junkie Ken Rudin, and we're going to talk more. We just heard about undecided voters. Well, we want to hear from them, of course, but we also want to hear from decided voters. What was it? What moment in the campaign helped you make up your mind for one candidate or against another? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan from Columbus. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Columbus, Ohio. We're broadcasting from the Battelle Studio at WOSU at COSI. Ken Rudin made the trip with us. He's NPR's political editor and our political junkie every Wednesday afternoon. He also writes a column called The Political Junkie. You can read that at npr.org. This state is one of a handful both candidates are focused on in the final weeks of the presidential campaign. In Ohio alone last week, the two campaigns spent almost $5 million on advertising, more than in any other state. Our focus today is on how you view the candidates. A month out, Iraq, healthcare, the economy have all emerged as major issues. What moments from the debates or during the campaign thus far, the conventions, define these two candidates in your mind? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And we're going to take comments from our audience here in Ohio. And Ken Rudin, let me ask you, it seems like a lifetime ago, back during the snows of Iowa, as they used to say, where Iraq was seemed to be the defining issue of this presidential campaign.
And it's interesting because John McCain would love to turn the subject back to Iraq and talk about how the surge is working in his opinion and things like that. But back in the spring, the snows of Iowa, Iraq was more of a Democratic issue, and it helped Barack Obama because unlike Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Chris Dodd, John Edwards, other Democratic challenges, they all supported the war. They all voted for the war in 2002. Of course, they later broke with it. Barack Obama, from the beginning, argued in 2002 that going to war was a mistake. And I think, at least in the fight for the Democratic nomination, it was an issue that helped Barack Obama.
Let's go to the microphone here at COSI, and we have Sarah. No, excuse me, Saran.
Yes.
Go ahead,
you.
Please.
I think the defining moment for me, I'm a first-time voter because I've just become a U.S. citizen about a year and a half ago.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I think it's really the caliber of the candidates. You look at Senator Obama and Senator Clinton, an African-American candidate, a woman candidate. This is really a historic moment from that perspective. And we're also at a point in history, I think, I'm not a presidential historian, but we're at a point in history where the world is changing very rapidly, and I think leadership is going to be key.
Can I ask where you come from?
I'm originally from India.
And obviously one of our larger democracies, too.
Yes.
India, did you participate in elections there? How are they different there than they are here?
Well, I don't think they start off 2 years or 4 years prior to the election, that's for sure. I think it is a democracy, and I think maybe participation is a little bit more than it is in the United States. So as large as India is, and you can just imagine when you have 1 billion people and maybe half of those who can vote and those people going to vote, vote doesn't occur in one day, it occurs over a large period of time.
Well, thank you very much, and again, congratulations. Ken?
You know, we were talking about expanding how many people vote in India, but of course more people perhaps may vote in this November 4th than ever before, at least in the general election. There are more young people voting than ever, or at least registered to vote. Democratic numbers are way, way up in many key states, but everywhere around the country. A lot of people attribute that to the excitement and the history making of Barack Obama's candidacy.
Well, a lot of people also ask about the accuracy of the opinion polls this time around, partly based on, well, they can only poll people who have landlines and not people who only have cell phones. But partly on this question of an expanded electorate, are we sure who's going to actually vote this time around?
Well, we never do. I mean, the polls have not been perfect this year. We remember the day of the New Hampshire primary, every poll had Barack Obama winning. Hillary Clinton did win that primary. But for the most part, they seem to be, I think, there's no outlying poll that shows John McCain leading. He did get a big boost with the picking of Sarah Palin. The Republicans and conservatives united behind his candidacy. But once the economy went south, or at least officially went south, when the Dow went south and losing hundreds and hundreds of points, the dynamic changed, the conversation changed, and that shifted to Barack Obama. Every poll shows that.
Let's see if we can get another caller on the line, and this is Cam. Cam with us from Miami in Florida.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my phone call.
And what was the defining moment in this campaign for you?
Well, first, when I realized that McCain had chosen Sarah Palin as a running mate, I realized that he had chosen someone who has been aligned with the Alaska Independence Party for several years in the beginning of this century. This is a party that favors the secession of Alaska from the Union.
That's actually not accurate, Cam. Her husband was associated with the Alaska Independence Party, but she was not.
Well, I read on the LA Times in an article that was published sometime in September that she actually spoke at several of the rallies.
Ken?
And,
She did speak at an Independent Party of Alaska convention. There were a lot of news reports that erroneously reported that she was a member of the AIP. Actually, by the way, Walter Hickel, who was a Republican governor, later became an Independent Party governor of Alaska. But they corrected it. She has never been a member. Both parties says that the Independent Party, as well as Sarah Palin's people, never was a member. She did speak to a rally once there. Convention
well,
there.
Thank you for the clarification. That's definitely worth noting. And lastly, it's something that I'm sure a lot of people have noticed, and it's the fact that when Obama made clear that McCain has voted 90% of the times in favor of George Bush's policies, it's kind of like the comparison you have between Coke and Diet Coke. With John McCain, you basically have 90% of the Republican calories that you had with George Bush. So in the end, we're going to end up with that same nasty taste in our mouths that's no good for our health and no good for the future of our country.
Cam, I take it you're not in advertising.
Definitely not for Coke, sir.
All right. Thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. You guys have a good day.
You too.
But in fairness to John McCain has broken with the president on some key issues and with the majority of his party on key issues, on issues of immigration. He is less of a nativist when it comes to immigration. He's talked about borders and getting people on the working and path to citizenship. Now, of course, that has hurt him with mainstream conservatives, and I think he's kind of switched his tune going back to a secure border. He also voted against the Bush tax cuts in 2001, said it was adding to the deficit. He also criticized religious conservative leaders. Of course, that goes back a bit. But yes, there's no question that John McCain in on his path to the Republican nomination, did swallow some of his words of the past and did move closer to the president on many key issues.
90% this year, a lower figure in years past.
Absolutely.
Let's get another questioner here in the audience at COSI in Columbus.
Yeah, hi, I'm Jake from Columbus. And at the outset of the campaigns, both candidates indicated that they wanted to run a clean campaign, but they've since resorted to attacks from both sides. So my question is, if these two men couldn't take the high road, do we simply have to resign ourselves to the fact that the low road's the only way to run and win a campaign?
And we'll get to Scotland before ye. But anyway, Ken, is this doom the idea of a civic-minded campaign?
Well, I think he's exactly right. Exactly, Barack Obama and John McCain were the two people you think if anybody's going to run a clean campaign. But he also said, is that the way to run and win a campaign? And I'm not sure it's the way to win a campaign because it's true that both candidates have been negative, but I think polls indicate that it almost backfires on John McCain as he makes his charges about whatever, about Bill Ayers, about things like that, about Reverend Wright, if that comes up. Every attack seems to have hurt himself in the polls.
But isn't the idea to, you may hurt yourself some, but you drive up the opponent's negatives, that has that effect too?
Yes, and that's exactly what we're watching to see. If the more and more undecided, now, the audience we spoke to yesterday, they did not come in undecided. It would be interesting to see if the negative attacks seem to take hold and more people are either hemming and hawing about the candidates or becoming more and more undecided, then you can go back to the old maxim that negative campaigns work. But this year, with the focus on everybody's financial future, it's hard to be distracted with issues like that.
Okay. Despite these attacks, are you planning to vote?
Yes, absolutely, but I kind of just want to get it over with. become a little disillusioned.
And I take it you don't own a television station here in Ohio.
No, I don't.
Thanks very much. Appreciate it. Hey, here's an email from Stuart in Palo Alto, California. By the way, we're getting a lot of calls from motivated Democrats. We'd like to hear from Republicans and independents, too. What was your defining moment in this year's campaign? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. This from Stuart in Palo Alto. The public asked a lot of thoughtful questions during last night's debate. Almost all of them were blown off, and the candidates went to the same set speeches they recited during the first quote-unquote debate. For me, both candidates were disrespectful to the public at large. Is there any way to structure these debates so candidates actually answer the questions asked? Ken?
Well, Sarah Palin, was more frank about it, says, I am not answering. I think it was either Sarah Palin or Tina Fey. I can't remember who said it, but it was the fact that she said that I would not answer your question. I want to answer the question that Americans want to hear. Both Barack Obama and John McCain are more adept at switching the topic like that. But I think it's true. Jim Lehrer tried very hard 2 weeks ago. Brokaw tried hard last night. They just don't answer if they don't have to, especially when it comes to sacrifice. They talk about crises. They talk about uniting behind a common cause, but when they talk about what Americans need to do, what the candidates plan to do in the wake of this crisis, they are very quiet about that.
Here's an email from Anne. When Carolyn Kennedy came out for Barack Obama, I discovered that a ceramic shell had formed around my heart after the death of Robert Kennedy. I intellectualized politics and I always voted, but I never really felt anything. When Carolyn Kennedy compared Barack Obama to her father and talked about people approaching her and making that comparison, the ceramic shell melted. I became emotionally engaged. I'm not sure what happens to me if Obama loses, but this may be my last hurrah. This email from Cranford. As a vet, I can tell you I made up my mind to vote in this election was when John McCain got the nomination of the Republican Party. I've read enough about his military record and the votes in which he was in the Senate concerning vets to make up my mind about his leadership and his character. So those contrasting views about the defining moments of this election. Let's see if we get Pat on the line. Pat with us from Milwaukee in Wisconsin.
Yes, how are you guys doing today?
Good, Pat. What was the defining moment of this campaign for you?
Yeah, the defining moment for me actually began in the primaries, and it was solidified last night when Barack kind of launched his campaign. He was, quote-unquote, a new kind of politician. And last night I heard that, obviously we have a huge deficit. He wants to give tax breaks to 95% of the people. Wants to provide universal health care, college affordability, and then he started also talking about, providing financial aid to these other countries. To me, we have so many problems here, and he just sounds like another politician making promises to every interest group he can, and is not going to be able to follow up on them whereas McCain, at least, I think, has more of a realistic approach and isn't promising the world.
So the defining moment for you, you hadn't made up your mind until last night.
Last night was, yeah, because I kind of bought into all the Obama, you know, something for everyone, above the fray. And the more I listened to him, he just seemed like a typical politician, kind of promising everything to everyone. The money's not there. And, you know, last night when he said, okay, on top of everything I want to do here, including tax cuts and all the increased spending, I also am in favor of propping up, you know, governments, financial aid in Sudan.
And Pat, just quickly, because we need to move on, but quickly, what did you hear from John McCain that solidified that, that made you think he might be somebody different?
Well, I like John McCain because he's not necessarily promising things he can't deliver. I think he's got some more realistic views on the key issues. And, you know, particularly the last instance, he talked a lot about he's willing to get involved, but only if it makes sense and will be beneficial for both the United States and the country to get involved. And then he cited some examples in the past. I believe it was Somalia where we went in and 300 Marines were killed. So, you know, I feel he's going to be a little bit more careful and do his due diligence before putting American resources and personnel at risk.
Yeah,
here
and
abroad.
I think, Pat, you were referring to Lebanon, and John McCain certainly did talk about Somalia, but it was the 300 Marines killed in Lebanon that you're thinking about. But anyway, thanks very much for the call.
Yeah.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're at the Battelle Studio at WOSU at COSI in Columbus, Ohio. You're listening to Talk of the Nation and the Political Junkie from NPR News. And, Ken, as we look ahead, defining moments are going to come fewer and, further between, I was about to say, just to continue the cliche, but there's actually not that much time left.
Right. There's one debate on the 15th, and that's going to be ostensibly on domestic policy, although basically every debate has been on domestic policy. And, of course, we still have, like, 27 days left of commercials that could change the difference. Obviously, everybody's the McCain people are hoping for some kind of October surprise. But it's hard to make the case that somebody's going to divert attention from what's going on right now with the economy.
Here's an email from Andrew. I'm an Obama supporter who backed him early, and not just due to his policies, but also due to his ability to speak to me through digital technology. I think this is extremely important because even with the very real digital divide, the new technology is shrinking the world for average citizens. Without an understanding of that technology, I don't feel a candidate can really have an understanding of the very real changes coming to our world. This is both a visionary future with utopian possibilities, but also a future of new and different security and energy issues. There hasn't been much talk about any of this, but I'd like to hear more about it. Well, maybe in the next debate. Let's see if we can get Julianne on the line. Julianne with us from Winston-Salem in North Carolina.
Yes, I've got a question about sexism and misogyny during the campaign, and just wonder how, when Ken Rhoden was so abusive of Hillary, he could still be on NPR.
Well, Ken Rhoden made a comment. A lot of people made comments. He apologized for it, and we've moved on.
I don't think you can move on when you've got the country out here and women who just feel like if it had been a racist comment, you wouldn't have kept him.
I was asked over and over again whether Hillary Clinton should drop out of the race. I said absolutely not. She's doing well in the primary. She's doing well in the polls. It's only the second inning. She should not drop out. I think people are underestimating her. And then I said, to my regret, that she reminds me of Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction. What I meant by that was not that she boils bunnies on the stove. What it was that she's underestimated. She's been underestimated her whole career, and to count her out was a big mistake. That's all I said. It was misinterpreted. I apologized. It was not a misogynist comment, at least from my heart of hearts. It was not a misogynist comment, but Keith Olbermann and Now and all these people decided that it was a sexist comment, and I have apologized over and over, and I apologize again to you if that's how you heard it.
Now let's go to Marty. Marty with us from Des Moines in Iowa.
Yes, I've been impressed with Obama since he spoke at the 2004 convention, and I continued my admiration of the man. I just think he carries himself so well. My deciding point was when he entered the race, and I have talked him up with my family and friends, and I caught an awful lot of flack in the beginning. But people are just coming around, and they're saying, you were right, you were right. I believe his initial statements about Washington is broke and it needs to be fixed. I wholeheartedly believe that, and I also believe
very quickly,
that,
Marty.
D.C. needs major surgery, not more Band-Aids.
All right, Marty, thanks very much. We appreciate you. And to thanks everybody who called. And Ken, one more thing before we have to go?
Well, yes, in the trivia question there, we were talking, one of the questions was about whether Dwight Eisenhower was born a state. We said he was born in Kansas. Of course, he was born in Texas. I was confusing Ike with Tina Turner, obviously.
Well, Ken, thanks as always. And Ken will be back with us next week when we do this broadcast, I think, from Virginia in Roanoke after the next debate next Tuesday night. So be with us then. Ken, thanks very much.
Thanks, Neil.
Coming up, 15 more minutes of fame, well, actually 17 minutes with Andy Warhol, a new retrospective on the artist here in Columbus, Ohio. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And a couple of quick corrections. The next debate is Wednesday night, not Tuesday night, as I said in the last segment. I apologize for that. And somebody called to remind us that Al Gore was born in the District of Columbia, not a state. So, well, we'll get that right. Anyway, thanks very much for all of that. If you walk into the Wexner Center for the Arts here at Ohio State University, you'll see screen tests, celebrity portraits, a couple arguing at a breakfast table in a 30-minute Verite-style film, 700 pieces of art, posters, movies, TV, magazines, interviews that anticipate YouTube, reality TV, celeb culture, the product of an artist who famously said that in the future everybody will be world famous for 15 minutes. The exhibit is called Andy Warhol, Other Voices, Other Rooms. Sherry Gelden is director of the Wexner Center for the Arts. She brought the Warhol exhibit to Columbus for its only show in the United States, and she joins us today at the Battelle Studio here at COSI. Thanks very much for being with us.
Delighted to be here. Thank
you. And
you.
We want you to join the conversation, too. When it comes to Andy Warhol's art, do you get it? And, of course, we'll hear from our studio audience here in Columbus. If you've seen the show, is it art? Is it a commodity? Is it junk passed off as art? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. And there's links there so you can take a look at some of the art we'll be talking about. But I wanted to ask you, Sherry, why is it that Andy Warhol inspires even such questions?
Well, what's fascinating to me about Andy Warhol is that some 50 years after he began working and even 20 years after his death, he seems ever present. He continues to, in a sense, define our own obsessions with celebrity and with instantaneous kind of gratification and with proclaiming ourselves back to ourselves, reflecting our world in all kinds of different ways. And in some respects, as you mentioned, he really foretold our complete desire to kind of be everywhere at all times and to make of ourselves celebrity. After all, I think it's fair to say that Andy Warhol has, in some ways, posthumously granted me my 15 minutes of fame.
The celebrity, of course, that he was eternally most interested in was himself.
Absolutely. And he made of himself his artwork. And the fact is he was alternately revealing and concealing his identity in so much of the work that he did. What's unique about this particular exhibition is the focus on the film and video work that he did in the 60s. As the story goes, he was so sort of taken with the fact that Americans watched the assassination of Lee Harvey Oswald on television, and with the endless repetition of the Zapruder film after the Kennedy assassination, that he immediately went out and bought himself his first video camera. And the rest is history.
He also carried a cassette recorder with him almost everywhere and recorded, well, almost everything.
Absolutely. In fact, there are some 13 audio booths in the exhibition where you can sit in a kind of foam-covered niche and listen to everything from his mother singing to cocktail chatter at one of those famous parties that John McCain doesn't like to go to.
Let's see if we can get some listeners in on the conversation. When it comes to Andy Warhol, you've seen the Marilyn Monroe prints, you've seen the Campbell's soup cans, you've seen a lot of the famous work. Well, if you go to this exhibit, you'll see some of the less famous work, but also brilliant stuff. Do you get it? Do you get what Andy Warhol was trying to get over? 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Joanne is on the line. Joanne with us from Wichita in Kansas.
Hi. I just wanted to say that I was so shocked and tickled. I bought an Amy Vanderbilt's complete cookbook at an estate sale in 1961, and the drawings are by Andy Warhol. You know, where he's carving roast beef, you know, there's all these very basic. I was just wondering if you could kind of tell me about that, how he ended up drawing in a cookbook.
I'm not sure specifically how he got that particular commission, but the fact is Andy began his career doing graphic illustration and advertising in New York City. He left Pittsburgh as a young man after art school, and his first job was doing shoe ads for I. Miller, I believe.
And some of the drawings in this exhibit are exquisite drawings of shoes.
Absolutely. I think he did have something of a foot fetish. That wasn't, of course, the only body part he focused on. But the fact is there are some fabulous shoes in the exhibition. And many other artist books that Andy did either illustrations for or kind of pop-up pages. He literally touched every aspect of visual culture, from album covers and artist books to all the things that he's much more known for, the paintings, the screen prints, the photographs.
Joanna, have you tried the recipes?
Yeah, and for me, I was just so tickled.
Whoops.
I didn't realize this is what he did, and I was delighted to see that, you know, here was this piece of Andy Warhol in a cookbook of mine. So that's all I'll take off there.
Okay, thanks very much for the call, Joanna.
Thank you.
Here's an email from Tom, and he writes, I never got Warhol until I saw an exhibit in New York City in the 1980s. The full-size format really works better than the small reproductions in books. And I think he's got a point there.
Absolutely. Although what you'll also notice if you come to see the exhibition in Columbus is that Andy really treated every aspect of his artistic practice equally. So a single Polaroid image is as important for him as a large-scale painting or a screen print or a film or a video. The fact that the marketplace has since declared different kinds of values, including for paintings that are going now at well over $80 million a piece. This particular show really tries to illustrate for the audience the fact that he was very fluid in navigating across all of these different artistic media. And in fact, his interest in film and video was very influential in how he approached painting and printmaking in particular, with the multiple views and the kind of storyboarding and the framing and the repetition.
Interesting that next to some of these multi-million dollar paintings, some of them quite large, you also see some four for a quarter photographs from one of those booths, you know, at the train station or at the arcade.
Absolutely. And Andy was also not terribly concerned about artistic authentication and authorship, which, of course, is causing great problems for people today who are loath to find out that maybe something they thought was by Andy Warhol was, in fact, not. But he was among the first artists in the 20th century to really work almost like a Renaissance artist with an atelier, a factory. And, in fact, he called the first studio the factory. People running in and out, both wielding cameras and paintbrushes and screen prints, as well as being the subjects of the films and the videos that he was making.
Our guest, Jerry Geldin, director of the Wexner Center for the Arts here at the Ohio State University, I'll get that right, in Columbus, Ohio, and they're running a marvelous exhibition on Andy Warhol. Let's see if we get another caller on the line, and let's go to John, and John's with us from Buies Creek in North Carolina.
Hi. Wondering if there's a connection to Truman Capote, the exhibit that is, because of the title. And I was also wondering if Andy Warhol, particularly his obsession with Marilyn Monroe and the Zapruder film, if he was influenced by J.G. Ballard.
The British science fiction writer, author of Crash, among other books.
There is definitely a connection, quite a deliberate one, to Truman Capote. The subtitle of the show, Other Voices, Other Rooms, of course, is taken directly from the Capote novel from, I believe, 1948, in which Capote is writing about a young man, an adolescent, kind of going out in search of his identity, and particularly his sexual identity. And this was something that Andy growing up in Pittsburgh very much related to, and in fact, when he first moved to New York, the story is that he would stalk Truman Capote until the writer, I guess, filed some kind of a complaint. Later on, of course, they became friends, and Truman is the subject of some of the works in the exhibition. I can't answer the question about J.G. Ballard. I have never run across any reference to that effect, but it could very well be.
Thanks for the question, John.
Thank you.
So long. Here's an email from Ray in Cincinnati. Without question, Andy Warhol took art off its pedestal and made it more everyday and yet special at the same time. It is fun, engaging, and challenging. And, you know, that takes me to what you're calling time capsules. These are, you think of time capsules as carefully selected pieces from certain periods of history that are meant to be a snapshot of our world at that moment. Andy Warhol had a different definition.
Very different definition. In fact, the time capsules really first began as moving boxes when he would go from one studio location to another and everything would simply be packed up in a kind of withered cardboard box and stashed away somewhere. And after he died, there were some 600 of these boxes that were then discovered and cataloged. Every single piece of paper in them, and the single time capsule that is on view in the exhibition has some, I don't know, 300 or 400 different items
but
in it.
These can be menus from Chinese restaurants.
Everything, receipts, menus, invitations, personal correspondence, photographs from magazines, notes on a film script, pornography, you name it.
Any indication that he intended them ever as a collection of some meaning that gathers from the collection of the objects?
It's not clear that he intended that, although I suspect that over the years, as his fame grew, he must have realized that everything that he kept would ultimately sort of see the public scrutiny.
Like Bob Dylan's trash, where it takes on greater meaning. We're again talking about the Warhol at the Wexner. Other faces, other rooms?
Other voices, other rooms.
I stand corrected. We're talking with Sherry Geldin, the director of the Wexner Center. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And there's somebody at the microphone here in Columbus.
Hi, my name is Steve Menendian, and I had a question. I saw the movie Factory Girl, and I think that movie sort of suggested that Warhol's commercialization of art had a dark side. So in the process of commodifying both art and celebrity, it sort of made people disposable. I was wondering, in the process, how your exhibit captures that side of Warhol's art and work.
There is definitely a quality to Warhol's work that is dark. He was fascinated with death and with disasters, as you can see from the paintings of electric chairs or car crashes or hospital scenes. And certainly the celebrities that he was drawn to have a bit of a kind of tragic cast about them, whether it's a Marilyn Monroe or a Jackie Kennedy following the assassination of her husband. So there was always a kind of undertone of kind of sensationalism on one hand and commodification, as you describe. Even the installation design for this exhibition treats the work much more as if it's on view in a store. It's arrayed on shelves, and the curator and the designer very much wanted to sort of represent his fascination with art as commodity by installing it in that way.
It's not for sale, though, is it?
Absolutely not.
Well, let's see if we can go to Lyndall, and Lyndall in Holland, Michigan.
Hi.
Go ahead, please.
I'm one of those people who doesn't get it. I think it's very bold of me to admit it. I have a minor in art. I grew up, I came of age in the 60s, and I just think he was very inventive in making money over a bunch of stuff that I can't get that excited about. If I could afford it, I would not buy any of his work anyway.
Well, maybe if you come to the exhibition, we can persuade you to change your mind. But the fact is, Andy Warhol is something of an acquired taste. It's not simply because he creates these endless images of familiar characters that you should feel you have to like Andy Warhol. I think for the art world, he was such a touchstone for so many things happening in the 60s that really relate to our broader social and economic culture and the sexual revolution. In that regard, he was really more of a kind of cultural figure even than many artists were, in that he kind of lived his art and he became the subject of his art.
Linda,
and I do get that. That I get. I just don't get why it's worth so much money.
Because somebody's willing to pay it. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And let's see if we can get Robert on the line. And Robert's with us from Philadelphia.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So I'm going to say that I do get Andy Warhol. I don't get Matt, but I get Andy Warhol in the context of, you know, as you all were just talking about, commercialization of art. I think that what he's been able to do is more reflected in his death. First of all, you know, now we have artists making more money while they're living than they ever were, as well as you know, artists like Murakami who are able to do these commercial art projects, and they're consumed as art even though they're meant to be commercial. And you know, I look at Andy Warhol as kind of a continuation of Aaron Douglas from the Harlem Renaissance, and sort of, you know, as you mentioned, with the workshop and the collective nature of how he created and how he helped others create, I think that as an artist, you know, just as an artist, this abstract individual who creates art, he's helped to create this image that's popularly accepted as art, as what an artist is. And so by virtue of that, I think that that's what makes him, you know, an artist, or makes what he creates art, despite the purpose.
Robert, thanks very much for the call. A lot of people will get it, I think, if they get a chance to see this exhibition. Sherry, thanks very much for coming in today to talk to us about it.
My pleasure.
Sherry Geldin is the director of the Wexner Center for the Arts. She joined us here at the Battelle Studio at WOSU at COSI, a science and technology museum in Columbus, Ohio. Thanks for joining us, and thanks to our audience here for being with us today. Talk of the Nation was produced today by David Gura and Barry Hardiman. Our director, Gwen Uten, our broadcast engineered by Drew Reynolds, Kurt Stallnaker, and Kevin Waite. Special thanks to WOSU Public Media General Manager Tom Ryland, WOSU Radio Manager Tim Eby, Marketing Manager Carl Higginbotham, and the entire staff of WOSU Public Media. Tomorrow we continue our Ohio road trip. Join us for a broadcast from Athens, Ohio. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Columbus.